listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, picture the scene. A small group of eccentric creative types work in a decrepit building and come up with an innovative product that sweeps the world, earning millions of dollars. The company sees ups and downs, takeovers, and drama, but that product ushers in a new era. Is it Silicon Valley? Seattle? No, it's Lake Geneva, Wisconsin in the 1970s. The product? A new kind of game called Dungeons & Dragons. Here's a game of D&D in action in the Netflix hit series Stranger Things.
The hooded cultists chant, "Hail, Lord Vecna. Hail, Lord Vecna." They turn to you, remove their hoods. You recognize most of them from Mokbar. There is one you do not recognize. His skin shriveled, desiccated, and something else. He is not only missing his left arm, but his left eye.
No! No! No!
No!
No!
Vecna's dead!
He killed my cat!
So it was thought, my friends. So it was thought. But Vecna lives!
Vecna lives, and so does Dungeons & Dragons. In his new book, our next guest tells the story of the rise and fall of TSR, the Lake Geneva company that made Dungeons & Dragons, and the buyout that kept the game alive. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you now, or have you ever been a D&D player? Were your kids, your grandkids, were you there at Ground Zero? Maybe even in Lake Geneva yourself? Did you play in the early days? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ben Riggs is a writer, teacher, and podcaster from Milwaukee, where he teaches English and history. He's the host of a role-playing game podcast called Plot Points, and his new book is called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons & Dragons. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here. It's a dream to be on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Fantastic. Well, glad to have you. Now, you tell the story not just of the creative side of the creation of Dungeons & Dragons, but also the business side. And this was, TSR was in the business papers, you write. What made you want to dig into that side of the story?
So it was a story that demanded to be told. About 6 years ago, I was writing for Geek & Sundry, and I was assigned an article tentatively titled, "Did you know that Dungeons & Dragons wasn't always made in Seattle?" And being in Wisconsin and knowing a bunch of the old hands back here, I was given the job of writing that article. And as I worked on it, one article became three articles, and people started sending me documents in the mail asking to be confidential. I got interviews with people no one had talked to before. So the writing stretched out over 6 years, and I was like, if I don't write this, no one will. And it's a piece of Wisconsin history that has not yet seen the light of day. So it's been a pleasure to write, and I'm really glad that people are reacting so positively to the book.
Take us back to the origin here. We've got this really in Lake Geneva, this local eccentric, as you describe him, Gary Gygax, go from, you know, an out of work cobbler at some points to the creator of this new kind of game.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that Gary Gygax is the most influential Wisconsinite in our state's history. And yet, nobody really talks about him much. Lake Geneva doesn't even have a statue to him. He was an unemployed insurance underwriter fixing shoes in his children's basement, who was designing wargaming rules for fun. And one of his kids told me, you know, he only made enough money from that to like take the family out to dinner once or twice. Then a guy comes down from Minnesota, Dave Arneson, and he shows Gary Gygax what he did with one of his wargames, a wargame called Chainmail. And Dave Arneson took that game and he used it to, he gave players a single character, which was new. They were exploring a dungeon, and these characters persisted from game session to game session and increased in power as they went along. And Gary Gygax was like, "Holy cow, this is amazing. Dave Arneson, give me all the rules to this game." So Dave Arneson sent him between 18 and 24 cribbed and cramped pages. Gary Gygax took that and set about making it into a rule set that would be called Dungeons and Dragons. But again, what he created was so radical, so new, we're still grappling with it today. It's like someone invented acting in 1974. Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson found something new to do with pencils, papers in your brain that no one thought of before. So again, it's one of the reasons that people oftentimes grapple with explaining how to play D&D and what D&D is. But Wisconsin saw the birth of a totally new medium, one in which the player is like the actor and audience at the same time. Again, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin really is a mecca. And again, I feel like we don't appreciate it properly within the state. Did that answer your question?
Oh, yeah. And now this company, TSR, Tactical Studies Rules, it stands for, they end up having this multi-million dollar product. Can you talk about how it went from that germ of an idea to this thing that really just swept the country, including to a young fella named Rob, just coming out of elementary school, if I could age myself?
So yeah, the growth of the game was exponential. Tactical Studies Rules, TSR, was founded because no other company would publish the rules. They just didn't see what the market for it was going to be. But the ability to take one character and control them and do anything was addictive. I want to say the first 1,000 copies sold out in a little under a year. The second 1,000 copies sold out in like 5 or 6 months. And it really saw exponential growth through 1983, as I recall. Again, it was slowed by the fact that it is really hard to explain how to play, but it's very easy to watch someone play and be like, oh, that's what you do in a role-playing game. It's why role-playing games have really taken off now in the 21st century, because YouTube allows you to watch people play all day long, and that's the best way to learn how to play. But the fact that D&D was so new and such an innovation, that really drove that first burst of growth through the early 80s. And then there was a crisis, and Gary Gygax lost control of D&D and the company, and the game was purchased by a woman named Lorraine Williams, who oversaw the company's silver age through 1997, when it was finally purchased by Magic the Gathering creators Wizards of the Coast, and took the game out to Seattle, and Wisconsin lost a jewel, sadly, although the Wizards of the Coast, I think, has done a very good job with it. Did that make sense?
Yeah, we're talking to Milwaukee-based writer, teacher, and podcaster Ben Riggs about a big piece of Wisconsin history. His new book is called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons, looking at the invention of a whole genre of games called role-playing game that ended up being influential in lots of other stuff, including computer games. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the history of the game, what it is, how it works? Are you part of that history? Do you play it now? Did you maybe years ago? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ben, as you mentioned, there was kind of there have been multiple crisis periods in the history of the game and of TSR. It seems like one problem was they'd come up with this product. They made lots of money at it. None of them really knew a lot about how to run a business, though, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, at TSR, initially you had, again, Gary Gygax was an insurance underwriter and cobbler. You had a pharmacist, you had a pipe fitter, and they were running the company. And, you know, life is well and good when your product is growing exponentially. And then when Lorraine Williams took over, again, she'd worked in business, but her degree was not in business. And she did hire business people, but she tended to hire, you know, like people from the cardboard industry are suddenly working at TSR, dealing with artists and writers. You had one executive come down to Brahm, a genius artist who would create these gloomy landscapes and these intriguing, mysterious characters, you know, but tended to be fairly monochrome. And this executive says to Brahm, now make sure you use all your colors in this painting because it's important, and which is a bit like telling Shakespeare to use more words. There definitely was a gap between the business ability of the people running the company and perhaps what it should have been. Role-playing games are also a difficult business. You know, if you drink a bottle of Miller, if you want more Miller, you have to go buy more. If you spent $30 on Dungeons & Dragons rule books in 1979, you could still be playing with them today and never would have needed anything else. The fact that, you know, this is an evergreen product that never goes bad causes real problems for role-playing game companies, because after you sell it to them once, what do you do? And Dungeons and Dragons has tried to come up with new editions and use that as an engine of growth for the game. And the current edition, fifth edition, is apparently a huge hit. I don't have sales numbers for it, but the Player's Handbook came out 8 years ago, and it's still in like the top 50 sellers on Amazon today. That's crazy. Wizards of the Coast claims that they've had 50 million people experience the game, even if that means 25 million people have played it. That's tremendous growth. Like I would say that when the game was in Wisconsin, it probably maxed out around 2 million players. So it's grown exponentially since it left the state.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kathleen is with us in Elgin. Kathleen, hi.
Hi. You're talking about Dungeons and Dragons, and I remember around Halloween of 1985, I worked at a club in Chicago called Limelight, and at the Halloween party, I met a guy, and it was a costume party, dressed like a vampire, asked me to go out for dinner, and I said yes, and on the way home, I realized I have no idea what this guy looks like when he shows up at the door. Well, it turns out he worked for TSR. He knew that I had a young son. And he brought with him, I guess, to curry points with me, every single thing that TSR had put out up until that point. And, I mean, the stuff just kept coming up to the door, box after box after box of stuff. And my son was, like, the hit of the neighborhood for, I don't even remember how every kid in the world ended up at my house, which I'd rather have than him going wherever they would go. And, yes, now he's 50 years old, and he has actually moved out of my basement. He doesn't still live down in the basement playing D&D.
Kathleen, thanks a lot for sharing that story. It's a great story. I don't exactly remember D&D in the 80s being the ticket to popularity, Ben, but it has changed in some ways from being this really niche nerd thing to a lot more people play it than that original core audience.
You know, I hope this might sound silly, you know, I teach 7th and 8th grade, and it was about a year ago, I wandered into the teacher's lounge, and it was filled with women under 30 talking about their D&D campaigns. And again, for me, as a white guy in my 40s, where role-playing games were pretty white and pretty male, it blew my mind. I would honestly tell you, as popular as role-playing games have become, indications are that it's even the rate of increase in players is about to go vertical. The speed of increase seems to be picking up, not slowing down, which again is crazy to think about. You know, when you think about how nerdy and niche role-playing games were in the 80s and 90s, you know, you feel glad that they're even talking about them on TV shows. But the fact that, again, I honestly believe that we're about to see a multiple of the number of people currently playing start playing, that is my prediction. Did that make sense?
Sure. Thanks for that call. We're talking to Milwaukee-based writer, teacher, and podcaster Ben Riggs about his new book. It's called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons. It tells the story of TSR, the Lake Geneva company behind the famous role-playing game. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the history of Dungeons and Dragons or what the heck it is? Have you played it over the last year, over the last five decades? Do you have a memory you want to share? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ben Riggs. He's from Milwaukee. His new book is called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons. You can join in with your memories, your questions at 800-642-1234. Memories from five decades ago or from a session last night. Rick joins us now in Evansville. Rick, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First off, I want to let you know that, yes, I did buy the book and I have started reading it. I've only gotten through the first chapter, but so far it's great.
Thanks, Rick.
Secondly, I used to play back in the day, late 70s, early 80s, you know, junior high, high school. And it was fun then, but it was a little harder to play because you had to make everything up yourself. You're playing there in your head with the rule book, a notebook, and graph paper. Nowadays, I've started playing again due to my daughter getting into it, and now my granddaughter is really getting into it. So we've started playing it again with the 5th edition stuff, and they've made it so much easier with all of the pre-written campaigns to go on. There's pre-written, pre-planned single-shot games where it, you know, you come in with a brand-new character, play for 2 hours, you know, do one adventure and then you're done, or you can continue those characters on to other adventures. You know,
Rick, thanks a lot for sharing the love that you're playing a multi-generational D&D there. Ben, what do you think?
I think that that intergenerational experience is becoming happily common. Again, like it's something that, you know, my parents never really understood, but now it does seem to be a thing that you and your kids can do together. I have an 18-month-old, and one of my friends was like, "Oh, only 10 years until you have a new player in your D&D campaign." And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, that's true." Also, again, there has been a huge proliferation of materials for Dungeons & Dragons. Wizards of the Coast did something radical with the D&D intellectual property about 22 years ago, and they opened it up. Essentially, anyone who wants to can make their own D&D rule books, can make their own D&D settings, put them up for sale on the internet, and make money off them and not have to send Wizards of the Coast a dime. And the result of that really has been an incredible richness of settings and adventures and options for Dungeons & Dragons players. It may be, again, one of the reasons that you're seeing this exponential growth in players is the IP is open. You know, it'd be like Disney saying anybody can make a Star Wars movie. It's crazy.
Thanks a lot for that call. We heard from Dan in West Salem who emailed about, it wasn't just TSR, but it was also the gaming convention Gen Con. It got really huge in Lake Geneva until it was finally moved, I think, to Indianapolis at some point. That was a big part of the story of Wisconsin's role in gaming, though, Ben.
Well, it's amazing. Gary Gygax also started Gen Con. You know, like, again, if you're looking for a reason to call Gary Gygax the most influential Wisconsinian of all time, he didn't only create a radical new medium. He created the largest tabletop and role-playing game convention in North America. It moved out of Lake Geneva to UW campuses. I forget which ones. Then it settled in Milwaukee for a good long time. And then when Wizards of the Coast bought Dungeons and Dragons, they ended up moving it to Indianapolis. And Indianapolis does do a really good job with it. Again, I feel like, you know, I'm a Milwaukeean. I went to Gen Con in Milwaukee. Indianapolis does a better job with the convention than we did. Again, it feels like Dungeons and Dragons, TSR, all of that has always been something that the state is more ashamed of than proud of. And I think it's one of the reasons we lost that convention.
Let's go back to our callers now. Valerie is with us in Milwaukee. Valerie, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What you want to tell us about?
Sure. So I'm 30, and I wanted to play D&D for a long time, but I was always kind of intimidated by it. And I have been watching a lot more web programs like Dimension 20 and Critical Role, where you can watch people playing these really long, wonderfully creative campaigns. And I think it's great to make it more accessible. And I just started playing my own campaign a few months ago, and I just want to kind of bring up that new exciting aspect of it.
Valerie, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Ben, yeah, there are a lot of things where you can watch other people playing D&D and other role-playing games.
Yeah, about huzzah for you, Valerie. About 14 years ago, I thought tabletop role-playing games were dead. I went and bought everything I wanted. I put it in my basement, and I thought, role-playing games are done. They've been killed by video games and the recession, and it's over now. People will look at it the way they look at Pet Rocks. But I could not have been more wrong. Both video games and the internet have been fantastic for tabletop role-playing games. Video games essentially teach you how to play role-playing games because they stole so much from Dungeons and Dragons, hit points, levels. And YouTube, which again, I thought people would be on there watching pirated South Park or something. Instead, YouTube is a gigantic engine for teaching people how to play Dungeons and Dragons with the best imaginable teachers, with voice actors and comedians playing the game, making it look just amazing. You know, not only that, but tabletop role-playing game has something that electronics do not have, which is just you have to gather with other human beings and experience the animal warmth of your fellows, which, again, when we're online all day with Zoom, when we are just engaging more and more electronically, being able to get together with people and to have to get together with them to play this game, it's just a tonic and antidote to all of that.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute, there is an effort to establish that statue that isn't there in Lake Geneva, I think, for Gary Gygax. What are you hoping for to get Wisconsin to recognize this part of its history?
Wow, that's a good question. I would say we could start with Governor Evers officially recognizing Gary Gygax Day, which just recently passed. Because, hey, again, if he's the most influential Wisconsinian of all time, we should at least take one day of the year and make it an official holiday here in Wisconsin. So that is what I will push for, sir, making Gary Gygax Day an official holiday in the state of Wisconsin.
All right, roll 20, difficulty 15 to make that happen, Ben. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. I'll be anytime you want me on. Oh, and if you're really interested in D&D, you can see D&D sales numbers on my Twitter page. It's at @BenRiggs_.
Ben Riggs is a writer, teacher, and podcaster from Milwaukee. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Slaying the Dragon, A Secret History of Dungeons and Dragons, looking at the origins of this incredibly influential new kind of game. Got its start in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. He tracks the twists and turns both on the creative side and the business side of things. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, you may have heard this piece of career advice. Follow your passion. We'll hear some pushback to that idea, saying that it doesn't really lead to happiness or to success. And a lot of people, speaking of jobs, have switched jobs over the course of the pandemic. A lot of them got pay increases when they did it. But our guest says that time may be coming to an end. Find out what's going on in the aftermath of the Great Resignation. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up after the news, credit card debt is on the rise in the U.S. We'll talk to a Marquette University instructor and financial advisor about how to manage our debt and have better relationships with our spending. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Gabelman investigation is over. Did we learn anything? We'll look at the outcome of the long-running election probe and what ended it. First, credit card debt in the United States rose sharply in the second quarter of this year. According to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, this last year saw the biggest jump in the rate of credit card debt that we've seen in more than 20 years. New York Fed researchers say higher prices and inflation are part of the story, and rising interest rates could accelerate the growth of that debt. Today, we're getting some financial advice on how to pay down credit card debt and avoid building it up in the first place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about dealing with credit card debt? Have you found yourself putting more expenses on credit cards, maybe as prices have gone up? Have your spending habits changed because of higher prices and inflation? Did you at some point in your life decide you need to get credit cards under control? What changes did you make? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Laura Reinholz is an instructor of practice at Marquette University's College of Business Administration, where she created and teaches the class Foundations of Personal Finance. She's been working in the financial services field for 10 years. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon.
What are some of the common reasons somebody might end up building up, you know, more credit card debt than they'd like to have?
Well, people build up credit card debt a lot of times because they're either not paying attention to what's going on or because something unexpected has happened. Perhaps unexpected medical bills, for instance.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there's kind of a stealth credit creep going on. Like if you always use your credit card to, say, fill up the gas tank or make regular purchases and those things go up and you keep doing it without really registering it, it seems like that could really sneak up on your monthly credit card bill.
Oh, absolutely. Years ago, when you went to McDonald's or any fast food restaurant, you would pay cash, right? because they would not accept credit cards. One of the reasons that they started accepting credit cards is that people don't always pay attention to how much their actual bill is going to be at the end of the month, because everything's all put in there together. So really paying attention to what we're spending our money on is going to be very important. And being cognizant that, yes, every time I'm filling up the gas tank, it's going to be a little bit more because of inflation. That certainly is something that we do need to consider.
Now, on a deeper level, what kind of things can we ask ourselves, I guess, about our money habits that that might solve some of these credit card problems down the road? What do we need to analyze in our money and credit behavior?
Okay, how much time do we have? Well, first of all, we have to think back to where we are. First of all, where are we right now? If we took a snapshot, how much money do we have in different accounts? And how much money do we owe to different entities? So if I have money in the bank, how much do I actually have in my checking account, in my savings account? Do I have other assets available? And then what kind of debt do I have? Do I have credit cards? Do I have store cards? Do I have student loans? Do I have a car loan? Do I have a mortgage? What I really need to do is do an analysis and figure out how much do I owe for everything and what's the interest rate that I'm paying on these so I can have a strategy. But even going back further than this, we have to think about what was it like when we grew up? Did we talk about money at home? Did we spend money to make ourselves feel better? If we think back to our background and our experiences and our education, that can help us figure out why we're doing some of the things that we're doing now. And we might say, this is a good thing. Or you might say, oh my goodness, you know, this is what it was like growing up. I want to be somewhere different. So we need to figure out where we are from a financial standpoint and also from a behavioral standpoint in order to determine what kind of steps we can take going forward. And then we need a plan as well.
And I think a lot of people might have an experience where you don't talk about money issues with people, and maybe you don't even talk about them that much with your spouse, or gosh, it seems complicated and scary. I don't even want to think about the money stuff. How can we overcome some of those hesitations in the first place?
That's a really good question. How do we overcome some of the discussions about money? First of all, just educate ourselves. And that could be something as simple as doing some Google searches and using some of the good, pay attention to the sites you're going to, but pay attention to some of the information you can find online and learn about different things. Do a little bit of research and find out what different kind of credit cards are available. What are some things I should be looking for in a credit card? What are some pitfalls that I need to pay attention to? And there's some really good websites out there. One is bankrate.com, and you can analyze different kinds of cards for that one. If you want to learn about some different financial things, you can go to finance.yahoo.com. Those are just a couple basic ones. If you want to do more, just dig a little bit deeper and look at things like the Wall Street Journal. So there are a lot of different resources that you can either subscribe to, or you can probably also get at your local library as well.
We are talking about credit card debt with Laura Reinholz with Marquette University's College of Business Administration. She teaches a class and created the class called Foundations of Personal Finance. You can join in with your experiences, your questions, 800-642-1234. Are you one of the apparently many Americans who saw credit card debt creeping up earlier this year? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I had a question. So I've been out of the country since I was like 18. And upon coming back, I wanted to get a credit card, but the bank wouldn't let me get one because essentially I've been off the grid. And I was just wondering what my credit score would be. I don't have any debt. I really had no bills in the U.S. I've been kind of off the grid. I'm wondering if my credit score would be zero or what number it would fall on.
And Jack,
that's my question.
I should ask just to get a time scale. You said since you were 18, about how many years has that been?
About 6 years.
Okay. Jack, thanks a lot for that call. A unique situation, maybe, Laura, but Jack is apparently invisible in some ways to credit card companies he wants to get a card from.
And that is a really challenging thing. Jack, you are right along with other people who choose to not use any kind of credit, and they're not going to have a good credit score either. So some different things you can do. If you're back in the States right now?
He hung up, but yes, we'll assume he is back here and trying to get this rolling. Yeah.
If he's back in the States, he can start trying to get some different types of credit. First of all, if he's paying an electric bill, that is one thing that will show up on a credit report. And then he can try to pull up some other things as well. Having different types of entities will allow him to build a credit score. I'm not going to say that his credit score is going to be zero. They actually don't go down to zero. But in order to have a good credit report, you need to actually have some credit. Kind of like you need experience to get the job, but you need the experience to get the job. One of those things. But there are a couple of resources that are available for you to look at, for anybody who wants to look at what their credit score is or their credit report. One is myfico.com, M-Y-F-I-C-O for myfairisaac.com. You can look at what goes into creating the credit score, because scores can go from, I think it's I'm not 100% certain on the bottom, but about 350 up to about 850 points. And you want to be well above 700, probably 720 up to 850 to get the best rate for any kind of loan or credit card. If your rate is a little bit lower, if your number is going to be lower, then your rate is going to be higher and it's going to cost you more money. So myfico.com can educate you with different things, and you can also see what your score is going to be. Of course, you can also buy into certain things, but there's a lot of free information there. The other resource that's really important and is also a free resource is annualcreditreport.com. I'll say it again, annualcreditreport.com. And this is where you can check what kind of history you have for your own credit. And you'll see a green light, a yellow light, or a red light based on if you're doing the right thing or if you've had some late payments. And if there are any errors, of course, you can try to get those taken care of as well. That is a truly free resource sponsored by the federal government. And you can get your credit report from Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. And you can do each one of those at least once per year. So you can check up to see how things are in order to make sure that your credit score is going to be what you want it to be. But being out of the country, not having the history, makes it a little bit challenging to start with that high credit score. You're going to have to build it up just by taking some actions.
Thanks for that call and good luck. Rebecca is with us now in Madison. Rebecca, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to talk briefly about budgeting apps, because those have been super helpful for me just across the board with my finances, but especially with credit cards. There was a time when I had a lot of credit card debt and I swore that I would never get them again, but I've actually been able to pay it off. And one of the reasons is having a budgeting app, because you can link all of your different cards, all of your accounts. And so a credit card isn't kind of this mysterious black hole where you feel like you're getting free money and you're not really seeing it come out of your budget. So I just wanted to throw out that tip that's been really helpful for me.
And Rebecca, if you want to name a name, do you have a budgeting app that's worked for you?
Yeah, I use Mint just because it's free, but I think there's a lot of other good free ones that are out there.
Thanks for that, Rebecca. Laura, any thoughts on budgeting apps on the market now?
I agree completely with Rebecca. There are some very good tools out there. The one that I'm most familiar with is Mint.com, or if you're old school, Quicken.com is a good way to track everything. Even if you don't have an app, there are ways that you can track how you're spending your money, and just that awareness can really help. Excuse me. In the class that I teach at Marquette, on the first day of class, I have the students start tracking all of their spending, all of the money. What did they spend it on? How did they pay for it? How much did it cost? What was the date? And the most important thing was, why did they spend it? If everybody was going to Starbucks and they just went along and they bought something from Starbucks, you know, the reason would be I was hanging out with my friends and everybody else was doing it. If they went to Starbucks because they had no other way to get some food, they were starving and they needed lunch, that's a different reason. Then follow that for a while and then take a look at your reasons why you're spending your money. And that can help you, along with those budgeting apps, to figure out what changes can I make? What do I feel comfortable sacrificing in order to reach my longer term goals? And that, you know, having a long-term goal is also going to be incredibly important. If I'm just thinking, well, I'm making money, I'm spending money, you're just going to get yourself on that hamster wheel going round and round. But if you say, I want to work toward this item, I want to buy some new furniture, I want to get a down payment for a home, I want to buy a different car in 2 years, Start taking those little steps now, and you're going to be able to reach those goals later on.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about credit card debt with financial advisor and Marquette University instructor Laura Reinholz, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your philosophy towards credit cards? What do you use them for? What do you try not to use them for? How do you handle credit card debt? Do you need advice or suggestions on how to manage it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Laura Reinholz, instructor at Marquette University's Business School and a financial advisor, with us today to help us manage credit card debt as borrowing goes up across the country, according to the New York Federal Reserve. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Did your monthly credit card bills get bigger over the course of this year? Have you made changes in your life at some point to bring down your use of credit cards? Get them under control. What questions, what experiences, what advice do you want to share? Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Milt is with us in Madison. Milt, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, hey, great topic. Laura, I have a couple points, and I'll just rattle them off and you can respond. First, I don't think that there's any coincidence that with the rise in inflation, we have a rise in credit card debt. So people obviously are finding themselves stretched and they're going to the credit card. And then the next thing I'd like to mention real quick is with the credit card, there is some tricks to managing your credit card and to knowing your billing cycle that I have found. Knowing what your billing cycle is, you can try and catch your payments that you need to make them after the last day of the billing cycle to get the extra 30 days or so of
Milt, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. We touched on inflation briefly, Laura, but are there ways to sort of game the billing cycle, as Milt is suggesting? Are you there, Laura? We're talking to Laura Reinholz, instructor at Marquette University's Business School and financial advisor. I think I heard Laura in the background there. We'll see if we can get her back. In the meantime, you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about credit or your experiences trying to get it under control. Maybe you used a budget app yourself to get your spending under control at some point in your life. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Looks like we don't have our guest back quite yet. Coming up in just a bit, we'll look at the end of the long-running Gableman probe of elections here in Wisconsin. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss appointed him to look at the 2020 presidential election outcome, how that election was managed, and then just recently ended that probe. We'll find out what was going on there and invite you to join in. In the meantime, we are looking to get our guest back as we talk about credit card debt. Let's see if we've got people with advice to share here while we wait for a guest. If there's questions, I can't really answer those, can I? How about Bruce in Cable? Let's bring on Bruce. There we are. Bruce, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share the fact that I'm 78 years old, and when I was about my late 20s, early 30s, I was traveled for a pharmaceutical company, and I was a credit card abuser. I ran up a really high credit card bill, and I was going to never use credit cards again. I was going to cut them up, and my dad said, don't do that. He said, use credit as a tool. He said, pay it off at the end of the month, and no matter what, just don't carry a balance. And I did that. That's 50-some years ago, and 47 years ago. And I've never paid a nickel's interest or late charge on any credit card, and I I run a business, so I average $3,000 a month, but it's always paid off no matter what.
Bruce, thanks a lot for sharing that story. I appreciate it. Laura, I think we've got you back now. I like that Bruce took advice from his dad. You know, it's not evil, but use it as a tool.
Absolutely. There actually can be some great benefits to using credit cards, and some of them are the convenience, because then you can just pay it off at the end of the month instead of having to write a lot of checks or use your debit card and try to track it as much. But there also can be some rewards. If you're constantly using your card, not constantly, but if you're using your card quite a bit, you can actually get more miles or rewards or different types of points or pennies back, which you can then use to help you help reach other goals. Or you can say, this is my funny money, I'm going to take it on vacation. There are some other benefits to credit card usage as well. If I'm buying something on a credit card and there's a problem with it, I may even have an extended warranty. So it's not all bad. If we are going to pay it off each month, it's going to be actually a really good way to track everything. The idea is to make sure that we do have the discipline in order to pay it off each month.
Thanks for that call. Joshua joins us now in Stevens Point. Hi, Joshua.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I'm kind of running off what that gentleman just said. I got two kids and I'm working class, and I have about $20,000 in credit available credit, but I put all my bills and everything on my credit cards every month on reoccurring because I get the rewards. Mm-hmm. I've been doing it for so long and paying off every balance that I actually went on my honeymoon pretty much for free because of all the rewards, and I pay the balance off every month. Yeah, but it kind of gets me into trouble because then I'm kind of cash poor sometimes at the end of every month.
And
I'm trying to reassess my budget right now, and I got a lot of help doing that, but I'm kind of going through a struggle because sometimes they can get away from me.
Gotcha. Joshua, thanks for sharing that, Laura. Any thoughts for Joshua?
First of all, congratulations on paying off your bill each month, and congratulations on paying for your honeymoon using the different points. So I think that's fantastic. It's good that you recognize that you feel cash poor at the end of the month. So that I would think you might want to take a step back and ask yourself, am I spending the way that I really want to be spending, or am I spending more? Are there ways that I can cut back so that I don't feel so cash poor at the end of the month? One other thing, too, you said that you have about $20,000 of available credit. One of the items that's important when looking at your credit score, which, remember, will help determine what your interest rates will be, is how much you're using of your available credit. So if you have a $20,000 available credit, if you're using $1,000 or $2,000 per month, you have about a 5 or 10% usage of your capacity. But if you're closer to $10,000 a month, for instance, then you're at about 50%. That's too high. So you want to think about how much you have compared to your overall credit that's available. And actually, going back to the previous call with Bruce, don't close down your credit cards. Just stop using them, because the history is another item that comes through on your credit report.
Joshua, thanks a lot for that call. We have just under a minute left. Laura, you want to leave us with a bit of inspiration for confronting a credit problem if we have one?
I think that identifying a challenge is the most important thing, and then thinking about what steps you can take for yourself, thinking about your long-term goals. What do you really want to do? And that's going to help you be able to get to what you need to do.
Laura, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I hope that everyone was able to get at least one or two little tidbits that they can use.
I imagine so. That's Laura Reinholz, instructor of practice at Marquette University's College of Business Administration, where she teaches the foundation of personal finance. She was with us today to look at a nationwide rise in credit card debt and how we can keep that debt under control. Coming up after the news, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss announced the end of his 2020 election probe led by former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman. We'll look back at the investigation and how it fits into wider efforts to contest the outcome of the presidential race here in Wisconsin and around the country. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.